Why so sad, Squonk? Because it's all shriveled up and ugly and also kind of cute.
Kind of like me.
But yes, guys, today with me is Lisa Russell of Cryptid Comforts, who you may know as the designer and creator of all those cute little cryptid plushy stuffed toys. But what you may not know is that she herself is a cryptid. Oh, there have been sightings of her all across America at various different cryptid festivals dressed as the Squonk. And that's what we're talking about today. The Squonk, the fearsome little critter that cries itself into a puddle of tears. Because Lisa has been on the forefront of revitalizing the legend and igniting public interest in this cute little whatever the thing is. 2022 was deemed the year of the Squonk, and Lisa also, during this year, is organizing Squonkapalooza. So I was very interested to ask Lisa, what does the Squonk mean to her? And how this cute little shriveled up thing helped introduce newcomers into the whimsical world of cryptozoology.
Hey guys, and today with me is Lisa Russell from Cryptid Comforts. Hello, Lisa.
Hi there.
So can you tell my listeners what Cryptid Comforts is for those who do not already know for some reason?
Absolutely. They should know. Cryptid Comforts is a business I started a few years back where my main specialty is cryptozoology themed stuffed toys that I hand make and I hand draw each one. So no two are ever identical. I don't use patterns. But from there, it's also taken off. And now I make all sorts of other items as well, you know, keychains, pins, lanyards, buttons. And then I also, just this past year, wrote a children's book that is all about the Squonk. So that is also something I'm doing now. I have all sorts of merchandise and things, and I tour all over doing events and showing it off.
Oh, yes. And when I saw on Instagram that you were going to events actually dressed as the Squonk, obviously I know people from this community have you on to talk, you know, about the merch aspect and the stuffed toys. But what I was thinking is you're actually conveying the Squonk and you are revitalizing the myth. I find that very, very interesting and very unique.
I love the Squonk. I fell absolutely in love with the Squonk when I first heard about him. And then I started making the stuffies in 2021. Since then, the Squonk has kind of taken over a lot of what I do and writing the children's book. Well, I guess I should tell people, for those who aren't familiar with what the Squonk is, a little background on the Squonk.
Sure.
So the Squonk was first mentioned in a book called Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods that came out in 1910, which is just like American folklore from lumberjack era. And that's where like the Hodag's mentioned also. There's all kinds of fun creatures in there. But the Squonk in particular, he is said to live in the hemlock forest in Pennsylvania. And he cries all the time because he's so ugly. His skin doesn't fit. It's all loose and baggy, and he's a weird looking guy. Now, my Squonk stuffies are pretty darn cute, I have to say.
Yes.
But he's got the big eyes with the tears and the wrinkly skin.
And the mouth. I think the mouth is the most unique part of it.
Oh, yeah, with the little tooth. Yeah,
yes.
Actually, the design for the face I got on Canva, like that site, like looking through there, I saw a monster face and I was like, oh, that's going to be my Squonk face. So It's not an original drawing per se, but I made it unique in the way that I used it. So,
okay, I was actually going to go into that. So your version of the Squonk has become a kind of icon now in the community. I was very interested, were you the first to make that design of the Squonk?
Oh yeah. So the way that I do the Squonk is unique to Cryptid Comforts. And I mean, like all of my creatures that I make start off as stuffies and I try to make them, you know, my own. And some of them change over the years. But typically, Like, you know, I get set on one way I want my my cryptid to look. And, you know, some of them, like the Fresno Nightwalker, is not going to be super unique, but mm-hmm. I make mine a little differently than anyone else does. So, yeah, but my squonk is, I try to put him out there as much as possible and make him well known.
I was going to ask you, is the squonk maybe kind of now the face of your brand? Is it the most best sold character you have?
I mean, nothing's going to ever top Mothman. Mothman's always going to be my bestseller, but squonk is actually becoming more and more popular. I mean, I sell a lot of Hodag too, but that's because of the Hodag store. But the squonk has kind of become my main thing lately, at least this year. And I've really pushed the squonk in social media. I've dubbed it 2022 Year of the Squonk. And I've been reposting any squonk art from any artist that I've seen on Instagram and, you know, tagged it with the 2022 Year of the Squonk. So just kind of trying to spread squonk awareness, and lots of other artists, I think, have sort of seen that and started making their squonk version, knowing that I'll put it out there. And so I think I've definitely built the squonk up a lot in the past year.
Yes.
And tried to make it well known. Oh, the coolest thing happened. I was at an event once, and Holly Houlihan, who's also an amazing cryptid artist, was at the booth next to me, and someone was in her booth looking at her squonk stuff, and they hadn't seen me there yet. I overhear the girl saying to Holly, well, yeah, it's 2022, Year of the Squonk. And I just was like, oh, yes, it is. And I popped over, and she knew exactly who I was, and was like, oh, hey. And I had actually met her the year before at CryptidCon. So it's just kind of cool. Like, this whole cryptid community, we really love and support each other. And it's fun to see that other people have created squonk art kind of because I started putting it out there.
Yes, yes. And like, to be frank, I feel kind of like a squonk. Today, in this whole year, we've had a few very bad years recently, and now 2022 is really the year of the squonk, because we all feel so alone and ugly, and just we want to cry ourselves into nothingness, just like the squonk.
That's so true. So true. And often when I'm like at events and people are asking me about the squonk, and I kind of tell them he cries all the time because he's so ugly, they're like, I relate. I feel
yes.
that.
I'm interested in the aspect. I have read that the squonk is known to, if seen, cry itself literally to death into a puddle of tears or bubbles.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You can never capture a squonk, because if you tried, it would cry so hard it would dissolve itself. So it really is like the saddest creature in the world, because it has such strong emotions that it dies. Like, that's terrible.
And it would rather dissolve into a puddle of tears than allow anybody to see it or catch it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really sad.
I also read somewhere that there is this kind of phoenix-like aspect, that out of the puddle of tears emerge baby squonks. Is that a part of the lore?
I have never heard that.
Huh. I heard that somewhere, but I can't remember where.
Interesting. No, I have never heard that. So if that's something, I should look into that, because that is not an aspect of it I ever heard. But it might have been, you know, something that later on people kind of came up with their own lore of it. I mean, that happens with most cryptids. Like, this isn't technically a cryptid. It's a folklore creature.
Yeah, it's a fearsome critter.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of crossover between cryptids and folklore creatures, clearly. But I think as far as the squonk goes, and I mean, pretty much any creature, like, people can come up with their own folklore that adds to it throughout the years. And I mean, this story of the squonk has been around since 1910. So I'm sure it's got variations on it all over the place.
And it's even dubious, like, if anybody ever believed that the squonk existed, or if it truly did emerge from lumberjack lore, or just from the writer of that book in 1910, because there was no written record of the squonk before that.
Right. I think as far as, like, with the Hodag, there is a bigger background story to how it came into existence. It wasn't just in the book, but I haven't found that with the squonk. I feel like the squonk kind of first came up in the book, but I think a lot of those creatures of lumberjack folklore, like the Slide Rock Bolter, for example, is ours here in Colorado, and it had you know, a history of people seeing things that didn't make sense to them and attributing that to a creature that, you know, so I think people sitting around campfire making up stories and these things came to life in a way. And it's really cool, like reading some of the creatures, reading about the creatures in that book. And then, you know, the history on how they kind of came to be is kind of fascinating. But I don't know about the Squonk prior to that book. Like, I could not find any accounts of any information on it prior to that book.
Yeah. And I find it very interesting that one guy in 1910 could just, you know, write a blurb about this Squonk thing. And it becomes a thing for a while where it's written about in all of these fearsome critter related books. For a while, like for a decade or so. Then it goes totally into obscurity. And then again, this Phoenix Resurrection thing, nowadays it is a pop cultural icon, thanks to you. And thanks to, I don't know, being such a cute archetype for sadness and ugliness, and adorable in a sense that every artist wants to make their own iteration of the Squonk.
And I mean, I love that there are so many creators out there now, you know, with their version of the Squonk, and I'm seeing some really great stuff like come out. And as far as I know, there's only a couple other people who have tried doing stuffies of the Squonk, and they all look so unique and, you know, nothing like mine. And everyone has their own version of what this thing looks like. Some people give it like a little elephant trunk on its face. Yeah. Some make it, you know.
Some make it like a pig.
Yeah, some make it more pig-like. Yeah, so everyone has their own unique take on it. And I think with most cryptid art out there, that's the great thing about it, is everyone can have kind of their own version. Like, yes, everyone in their brain kind of sees what a Bigfoot or a Loch Ness monster might look like. But then in your art, you get to kind of create your own version of that and have fun with it.
Yes, that's why I often have artists on my show. I am really not interested in the reality of these things. I'm interested in how we use them. Like, be it real or not, it is already something present in the public consciousness. So how are we utilizing it, and how is it propelling us into the future? Because they are all icons and symbols now that are influencing us.
Right. And I mean, for me, like when I first fell into, you know, learning about cryptids and stuff, it wasn't that I was a believer or anything. I like to refer to myself as a hopeful skeptic, which in that it's like, I don't necessarily believe that all these things exist or anything, but it just makes the world a little more interesting that, you know, they could.
Yes. You often bring up on podcasts the example of how you love the unicorn, but when you went into the history of what inspired the unicorn, it was much more fascinating.
Yeah, I love the history of those things and learning, you know, where the lore comes from and how it's changed over the years is something that really fascinates me, and I enjoy that so much.
So how did you learn of the Squonk? Like, when was your first time hearing about it?
I don't know. I really don't remember. Can't point out a particular time that it was just like, oh, here's this creature. I should learn more about that. I don't remember that happening.
Because I was going to ask you, like, how prevalent was the Squonk in this artistic cryptid community before you started creating these stuffies?
I mean, some people had put stuff out there. Like, I know the Moth Boys had a podcast episode about it, and someone else, like, I don't know. There were a few people who, I probably came across the Squonk through another creator, but I can't place exactly where or who that would have been.
It's kind of reflecting probably how the original book was read. Like, I heard of this thing, but I don't know when and where.
Right, exactly. But I do remember when I made the first Squonk plushie, I was at my parents' house, actually, because I stay with them a lot while I'm on my tour on the east side of the country. So I was at their house when I made the first one, and came up with the idea for the children's book shortly after, which in my mind, like, the book that I wanted to write was for kids, had to do with body positivity and, you know, things like that, because here's this creature that is so miserable because of its, you know, looks. And I'm like, that's something that I feel like everyone can relate to at some point. Like, we all have insecurities, we all feel bad. And so in writing the book, it started off that the Squonk is crying kind of because he's being bullied. And then I wanted Dogman to be my secondary character for a couple of reasons. One, there are Dogman sightings in that same area. So it would make sense that they would run into each other in the woods. But also because the Dogman is thought of as ferocious ferocious and vicious and mean. And yes. In my book, the dog man is the one who's showing kindness and compassion to the sad squonk that he comes across in the woods. He hears the squonk crying and goes to find him to comfort him and befriend him. And so the book is really all about kindness, compassion, and friendship. And kind of in the end, I'm going to do a little spoiler alert on my book. In the end, squonk asks dog man if anyone ever makes him feel bad. And he tears up and he's like, yeah, people think I'm mean and scary. That really, you know, hurts his feelings. And squonk's like, what? You're so nice. And so the idea, I think, that I was trying to get across in my book is that everyone has these things that make them sensitive, that make them feel bad, that hurt their feelings. And, you know, just trying to show what a little bit of kindness can do to make the world a better place was really what I was going for. So, yeah.
Yes. And I think that's a very positive message. I like the way you used the dog man, because everybody projects this sort of fear onto the dog man nowadays.
Right. And so, I mean, that was a big reason why I needed the dog man as my secondary character, was to, you know, have him be the compassionate, kind one, the loving one, the one that, you know, showed this squonk that, you know, he was beautiful. And so having just a gentle, kind dog man really was what I was going for.
I find it also very interesting how it's a parallel of two folkloric creatures a century apart. Like, yeah. In 1910, lumberjacks were very hardy men, every day working through the number one most lethal occupation in America. So, you know, they were constantly seeing death left and right.
Right.
Yet they create the squonk, which is a miserable creature that they can make fun of.
Yeah.
And nowadays, 100 years later, when we have all the comforts of modern life, we're imagining the dog man as a vicious, bloodthirsty thing out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting way of conveying that these two creatures are essentially the same. They're two living beings with their own feelings, yet we are the ones projecting our own societal issues upon them.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that that could point to anyone who's being picked on for being different, for, you know, anything. Like, and I remember when I was a teacher, I had a student who was very sensitive and would often construe somebody joking around as them picking on him. And that wasn't necessarily the case. And me pointing out to him, like, the kid who he was thinking was his bully was also sensitive and felt bad about things. And he's like, what? You know, like, not understanding that that student also had his own stuff going on that made him feel insecure and bad. And so I think pointing that out really did kind of change the way that the two of them treated each other in the long run. And so I think that's kind of, I guess that probably helped inspire my book a bit.
I wanted to say that, and like, if you did the dog man as a bully that by the end of the book learns of his own humility, that would have totally resonated with that story.
Yeah, but in my book, the dog man always starts off as just kind and gentle and wonderful.
Yeah.
So I think that the idea that people think of him as mean is just wrong, flat out wrong.
Yes. I mean, my friend Christina, I don't know, you probably know her, the Crescent here.
Yeah.
She also did a squonk artwork recently, Squonk Fae with fairy wings.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah. I'll send it to you. But she always talks about, like, she's not afraid of Dogman, she's afraid of people. Like, Dogman is only scary and vicious because we're in his territory and he doesn't want anybody in his house, basically.
Exactly. I mean, like most wild animals, you don't want to screw with the wild animal because you don't know what it's going to do. But if you're on its turf, it has every right to defend itself. And I think a lot of humans think that we have dominion over the animals. And I think that is so messed up.
Yeah. I think using cryptids nowadays as these folkloric figures, as allusions to these archetypes, characters, personalities, societal issues, we can use them as you are using in your children's book to kind of teach children in a way through these cryptids that are a part of nature, that maybe there is more to nature and maybe that it should be respected just as any person out there.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to also quickly ask you about the Slide Rock Boulder, if that's how it's pronounced.
Yeah.
So can you tell my listeners what that is? It's a Colorado fearsome critter.
Yes. Yeah. The Slide Rock Bolter is said to be basically, it's kind of like a land whale type creature. And on its back, it has like two little hooks on its, the back of its tail fin thing. And it can, so it can hold on to like a rock or a tree or something. And it positions itself up a hill, and it has to be at least a 45 degree angle hill above like a little town. And it'll stay up there clasped onto whatever it's holding until it sees a group of unsuspecting tourists underneath. And then it slides down, gobbling up everything in its path. And so the kind of history of that comes from back, you know, lumberjack days. Prior to the lumberjacks coming through that area, we had mining in that area. There was the gold rush, and then there was mining. And so there's all of this destruction. The land that had been thriving for hundreds of thousands of years was suddenly, you know, like trashed. And so there's all these areas on the side of the hill with, you know, like down trees and, you know, rocks and things. And it looked rough. And then underneath, you'd see like what once was a little town that just was kind of demolished. And rather than people thinking that they were responsible, that humans could be responsible for this, they created this creature that must have been responsible for it. So I found that to be kind of fascinating, is that's pretty much, that touches on a whole lot of things. Humans like to blame other creatures for the things that they have done. And it couldn't possibly be the fault of humans coming in and destroying the land. It had to be some weird monster. And so they created it as this like town swallowing gigantic land whale.
Yes. And I think it's very interesting. Like a lot of people who are into cryptids, sure, they like the surface level of them. Oh, these are cool creatures, whatever, monsters. But when you go into the history of them in depth, like what you just said about the Slide Rock Bolter, you uncover a lot of historical events that led to the creation of the creature, which are much more important and interesting than the creature itself. So I find it also ironic how back then they created this creature as a personification of a natural force to explain why everything was wrecked there. Oh, it's not us, it's that creature.
Yep, it has to be some monster that came in. Yes. And did this. But instead it was people from the gold rush setting up towns and then demolishing them, and then the mining is what caused, you know, the kind of slide looking things on the side of the hills. So yeah, it is interesting that...
And it's interesting how that myth prevails for over a century, that now somebody will be attracted to the idea of the monster. They'll then want to look into the history of the monster, and then we rediscover the hidden dark side of the story.
That's exactly what happened here. Like, I didn't think much of the Slide Rock Bolter till I moved to Colorado, and I was like, obviously I have to start making a Slide Rock Bolter stuffy because I live in Colorado now. But when I actually was doing the research into kind of the history behind it, I was like, well, that is fascinating.
And you can even do a children's book with the Slide Rock Bolter, how everybody is blaming him for destruction, and yet he's, you know, a peaceful creature that eats fruit or something.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
That might be my next book.
Huh, interesting. So what fascinates me the most, and why I had you on my show? I recently did an episode about the Selbyville Swamp Monster, which is a monster in Delaware, a made-up monster. So in 1964, a resident of the town dressed up as a Bigfoot thing and then spent a few months scaring drivers across along a highway
through the swamp.
Yeah, until people started gathering in posses and trying to shoot him down.
Well, yeah, there's always that dark side of pretending to be a creature.
Yes. But the thing is, for decades after he stopped conveying the creature, people still kept seeing the creature there, even though he was not, you know, dressing up as the creature anymore.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
That is an interesting, because I think that happens with a lot of cryptids. Like, once there are sightings reported, other people suddenly are like, oh yeah, I saw that.
Well, the thing is, with the squonk, recently people have been reporting sightings of the squonk all across America, wherever you go. I wonder why that is.
Could be the giant squonk suit I wear. Yeah, it's pretty funny. I was actually very inspired by my friend Ben from the Hodag store in Wisconsin. I'm sure you've seen his Hodag suit.
Yes, anyway. Yes.
I absolutely love it. And it's so much fun. And just seeing him and his friends having a blast doing that, I was like, well, I want to do that. And so also, you know, to promote my book and my wares and stuff, I decided to have this squonk suit custom made. So the body of it, I just bought like a onesie and sewed wrinkles in. And then the head I had custom made from my art. So a lot of times when I'm out and about wearing it and kids see me who don't know what a squonk is, I'll get a lot of sad kitty, sad piggy comments, but it is really, really exciting when someone knows exactly what I am and yells, oh, it's the squonk. And I love that. And I had a lot of fun at Mothman Festival wearing it. It's hard for me because I do a lot of these festivals by myself and don't have help. So it's hard to wear the outfit and work the festival. But when at Mothman, my niece was there with me, helping me. And so she would run the booth while I ran around in a squonk suit. Of course, I only did it in the morning because it got so hot in the afternoon. Yeah, wearing a mascot suit is actually much more difficult than people might think because it is really hard to see out of, especially in a crowd of people. And I know a lot of people say that when you're wearing a mascot costume, you shouldn't talk, which is also very difficult for me because I'm the talker. So I have a lot of fun with my squonk suit and I love it. And Ben and I, after Cryptid Bash, he came out to Cryptid Bash to just kind of surprise everyone and hang out. And so I picked him up from the airport and he and I went and, you know, we both had our mascot suits. So we did all kinds of fun photos. And then after the festival, we went out to Grafton and did some photo and video in Grafton and just had a blast. So it's a lot of fun when you have someone out there with you to act goofy with and have fun with. So I definitely enjoy when Ben and I can get together, both wearing our mascot suits and being silly. And a woman saw us putting on our suits in the street and was like, what is going on here?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Like, how often do you stumble upon locals at these festivals? Because I assume most of the people you see at the festivals are not local.
A lot of locals do show up, but a lot of people from out of town show up too. The Mothman Festival, everyone shows up. I mean, the locals come by, not all of them because a lot of them hate us, but quite a few come out. But people travel all over the country to come to Mothman Festival. It is the biggest festival in the world for cryptids. And so that's, you know, our big one. Cryptid Bash, I think we had, because that one was in Morgantown, West Virginia. And I feel like, you know, a lot of people who are into cryptids live kind of close to West Virginia anyway. So, I mean, we get a good mix of both local and out-of-towners. But yeah, you'd probably more people come from out of town. But as cryptids are becoming more and more popular in society, we're seeing a lot of increase in people in general coming out, more festivals. And it definitely... It's so hard for me because I live out in Colorado where we don't have any like cryptid festivals or anything. There's like one great event out here called Monster Day Greeley that I did last year, but otherwise I haven't really found any. And that one, nobody knew what cryptids were, but they were into me because of, you know, the monster aspect. But I wore my squonk suit to that one too, and I sold a ton of books and people seemed really interested in hearing about it. So that was cool. But yeah, I haven't found a whole lot of events in this part of the country. Most of the events, like there's a few I did on the West Coast that were pretty great, but a lot of them are east side of the country. So hence my going on tour, which it's hard though, because I can't be gone all year long. And it would be a lot easier if I lived on that side of the country and could just go for the weekend. But instead I have to try to book, you know, events that are back to back that all fit into a clump so I can do as many as possible in the shortest amount of time that I'm out there. And it means I miss some, like last year I had to miss CryptidCon because it was in November and it's harder for me doing the back and forth. So luckily I have a good home base in Tennessee that I can use when I'm on the East Coast. My parents are super supportive of what I'm doing. And I really enjoy that, being out there and going to events. I wish that I lived closer to my events.
I wanted to ask you, so what's the deal with Loveland? When we're talking about locals who hate cryptids.
Right. So Loveland is the cutest little town that really should embrace their cryptid and don't. There's nothing Loveland Frogman really around. Holly and I stopped there after the Ohio Bigfoot Festival last year. Yeah, we knew from hearing about the town that there was no love for the Loveland Frogman, but we were a little disappointed at seeing how little they acknowledge it. But the town itself is super cute and really nice. And she and I joked about moving there and opening up a Loveland Frogman Museum and how fun that would be. But yeah, that town, like, I feel like towns who embrace their cryptid are awesome. Like, Rhinelander, Wisconsin is the coolest place. Not only do they embrace their cryptid, but it is literally on their police cars, on their ambulances, their school mascot. Like, it is amazing.
And also Douglas, Wyoming with the jackalope.
Yes. Well, so my boyfriend actually recently was in Douglas, Wyoming and stopped to, you know, pick me up some jackalope stuff and was surprised by the lack of jackalope that he actually had trouble finding me jackalope merch.
Wow. So I know they do have a festival. I know they have a statue of the jackalope in the center of their town.
Yeah. I think I haven't actually been there, but I would like to look into that. That jackalope festival would be fun. I should look into that one because I haven't heard about that one.
Allegedly, they sell jackalope milk in cans.
That would be awesome. Okay. I remember teaching my students. So when I was a teacher, I would do summer discovery classes that were cryptozoology classes for kids. And I remember the first time I taught my students about jackalopes and, you know, that if you actually see a rabbit with what appear to be horns on its head, that it's actually that the rabbit is very, very sick and has, you know, papilloma?
Sure, papilloma virus.
Yeah. And so I was teaching the kids that. And for the rest of the week, just every once in a while, one of the students would say, poor, poor sick bunnies. It became kind of our mantra of the week. Poor sick bunnies.
I wanted to go back to Loveland, so here's an idea for your next book then. The Loveland Frog being chased away from his own town and going to Pennsylvania, meeting the squonk, and the squonk is, oh, well, we will accept you here.
Well, I think, you know, that's, yeah. The Loveland is such a great town. They really should do more for their frog. But there is going to be a Loveland Frogman Festival this year.
Yes, not in Loveland.
Not in Loveland, unfortunately. And I won't be able to attend, unfortunately. But it is cool that the Loveland Frog is getting a little more attention also. I really wish that the town would see that it's a good thing to have a cryptid. It's a good thing to have that folklore. And I mean, a lot of people in Point Pleasant, West Virginia hate Mothman at this point because they hate the tourism. But I see it as such a positive thing. I mean, the town thrives on the tourism. Like, otherwise, that town doesn't really have a whole lot going on. It's a really small town in West Virginia. And the main thing that happens there is the Mothman Festival. So, but people, locals, really don't love it. And I lived in a small town in Washington, and I kind of, the locals who had been there, you know, their whole life, didn't love all of us city folk moving in. And so I think it's kind of the same thing. You like your way of life the way it is, and you don't want other people messing with that.
I think in Point Pleasant, it's also maybe because the Mothman is tied to a tragedy that occurred. So it's
that's valid. I mean, but I think people just really don't like all of us weirdos coming to their town. That's really
But here's the question. So Cherubusco, Indiana has a festival for the Beast of Busco.
Yes, it's called Turtle Days, and I've been wanting to do it, and I'm hoping I get to do it this year. It's like a 4-day festival. And I mean, that whole town is, I haven't actually been there yet. I keep wanting to go, but I haven't had a chance yet. But yeah, Turtle Days is a big 4-day festival in their town, and they do Turtle Days Christmas event also that just happened. And they really, like, they call themselves Turtle Town USA.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's Turtle Days, it's not Cryptid Days, so how will they react when a stampede of cryptid guys goes there to their festival, which is not technically cryptid-oriented?
Right, so the idea of Turtle Days, yes, it started because of the Beast of Busco, but I think a lot of people don't know that, and a lot of the people who go there don't really know anything about cryptozoology, and so I'm interested to see kind of how that goes when I hopefully am a vendor there this year. Hopefully. I'm trying.
It would be very ironic if they reject the cryptid guys because they themselves don't understand probably that Turtle Days spawned because of a cryptid story.
Right, exactly. I'm not really sure because I've never been to the town. I don't know a whole lot about how, but I do know that it's Turtle Town USA, and so the Beast of Busco is from that. I don't really know a whole lot, and I'm interested to see because I'm making Beast of Busco stuffies, and I'm excited to go and hopefully, I think because the stuffy, basically, it just looks like a turtle stuffy, but on its belly, it actually says Beast of Busco.
So you're going to these festivals dressed as the Squonk, and children are seeing you and starting to learn what the Squonk is.
Yes.
So imagine down the line, like in 20 years, somebody tells their children, oh, I was at this festival in my hometown once and I saw the Squonk, and a whole myth forms because you dressed as the Squonk.
I love that idea. I mean, I hope that kids are being somewhat impacted by what I'm doing, and that, you know, just seeing that brings people a little bit of joy. And I did have a lot of kids ask to have their picture taken with me at the Monster Days in Greeley, you know, kids who had never heard of the Squonk, but I would tell them the story. I mean, I lost my voice after Mothman Festival because I told the story so many times. But yeah, it's nice. And I think kids like, you know, seeing anyone in costume like that. That's very appealing for children and adults alike. But children especially seem to be very drawn to it and get excited yes. when they see me. And
I'd imagine in these small towns, children who do not have maybe the capability to go to Disneyland or stuff like that.
Right.
So they otherwise would not see somebody in a mascot costume, maybe for a college football game or something.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea is bringing a little bit of joy to people, and I hope that I can do that. My tagline for my business used to be, for my old business actually, where I just did regular stuffed animals, not cryptids, but it was making the world cuter one stuffed animal at a time. So, I mean, the whole idea is, you know, anything that makes life a little happier, makes someone smile, I'm all about it. And so the idea of taking these monsters and making them into something cute has always been very appealing to me, because I want it to all be so kid friendly. And I mean, I do Cryptid Crate Junior, which is for children. It's a Cryptid Crate version specifically marketed towards children. And I make plushies for it every single month and curate the box and find, you know, awesome, cool cryptid artists to go in it. And, you know, we try to make it as cute and cuddly as possible. And I remember when we were doing the Mongolian Death Worm,
which has death in its name.
Right. So Matt was a little like, I don't know. And I was like, kids love the Death Worm. And the t-shirt that Danner of Conjured Us designed for it was so cute. And it said, at the bottom, it had the words Mongolian Death Worm, but then death was marked out and friendship written under it. So it says Mongolian Friendship Worm. So cute. And so I just love the idea of taking these things and making them cute and approachable.
Is that why you don't call them night crawlers, but rather night walkers?
Well, I do that because they walk. They don't crawl. I think it's weird that people call them night crawlers when they're not crawling. They're clearly walking. Such a weird yes. thing that they became night crawlers. Night crawlers are earthworms. It's very, very strange to me. Usually, like when I do hashtags and posts and stuff, I wrote both of them, but in my mind, they are always night walkers because they walk.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, is that maybe a way to make it more appealing to children and less scary? Because I do approve of this approach of making cryptids more cute, you know, less scary. I'm tired of scary monsters.
Right.
And people are the scariest monsters, not cryptids.
Absolutely. I could not agree with that more. I mean, yeah, some of the art that I love of cryptids, there's some really creepy, fun art out there that I'm really into. And I love, you know, scary movies and anything horror. Like, that's, I love all of that. And I think that's really a lot of the duality in my personality, is that not only am I, you know, in my work making everything so cutesy and happy and adorable, but then the other side of my personality is that I love all this, you know, dark true crime and horror movies. Mm-hmm. And those are kind of the two sides of me, that I have this super light and fluffy side and the super dark side, and it works to make me who I am. And I have a lot of fun with what I do. So it makes sense to like take monsters and kind of work that into, you know, this cuter side of me.
So what got you to shift your focus from making stuffed animals to stuffed cryptids?
So it all started, what year was that? Like 2016, maybe 2016, I think. Either 2015 or 2016 was the first Oregon Bigfoot Festival. And I happened to be teaching my first cryptozoology class that year accidentally. I'm sure people have heard me talk about this on other podcasts if they've heard my podcast, but kind of started when this woman named Fuff recommended that I teach a class called Unicorns, Unicorns, Unicorns. And I was like, meh. I was like, I don't like unicorns, but maybe something, you know, that would have a broader appeal. So I did Unicorns, Dragons, and Bigfoots. Oh my. In my mind, when I first started doing that, the idea was to take mythical creatures and just have a fun art class where we made art about mythical creatures. But so when I started researching for the class and finding, you know, out more and more about cryptozoology, I was just like, this isn't necessarily all just mythical. And now I actually take offense to people who call them mythical. And the history behind the unicorn and the dragon, and then all of the sightings of Bigfoot. It's like, okay, this is all super fascinating. And so I started broadening and listening to more podcasts about different cryptids and learning more and more and more. And I signed up to be a vendor at the Oregon Bigfoot Festival that year and just started making Bigfoot stuff and realized there's a good market for that. And I had more fun doing that. And I was like, and the more I started, then I started making Mothman stubbies. And then, so I like to say that Bigfoot was my gateway drug into cryptozoology.
Oh, as it is for many people who are into cryptids.
Exactly. And now I'm obsessed with all things cryptid. But slowly, it didn't happen right away. It slowly took over. Like, I was doing both for a really long time. And then eventually I just got to the point where more people were interested in the cryptids than they were in the regular stuff. And so I came up with a new business name. And
in a way, it also enables you to kind of appeal to both sides of your duality.
Absolutely.
Because you did not have the scary aspect with stuffed animals, but Now you are doing both things that appeal to you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, you don't know this. I used to work as a biology teacher myself.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I definitely understand how making these creatures, these cryptids, cuter and more appealing to children can also allow us to, as teachers, use them as gateways to science. I already talked about this with the hosts of Monster Talk, the podcast,
Okay. Who
were also talking about monsters being used as gateways to science. Like, many people grow up more interested in monsters than real animals and real natural occurrences, but through monsters, they learn scientific concepts and become more interested in real science. So definitely we can use cryptids, and by making them more cute or less monstrous, we can use them to kind of teach all these concepts to kids, especially in school.
Yeah. And I mean, I like the idea that kids are, because I mean, a lot of kids that I knew were super into dinosaurs when they were young. So the idea that there's this creature that we've never seen in real life because they went extinct long before we lived. But that's what's fascinating. It's like, I don't see this on a regular basis. It's not like seeing a dog. Dinosaurs have a more fascinating thing because you can't just see one. And so a lot of it is so imagined. You imagine what one looked like from the bones and the fossils and things.
Because they have a hard science basis, it is not as malleable as cryptids. Like with cryptids, every child can turn a cryptid into their own version of the cryptid.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, all we have are these eyewitness accounts. We don't have bones. We don't have fossils. We don't have any hard evidence. And I do love, though, like former cryptids that have been proven real is also always a fun thing to teach the kids in my cryptid classes. So we go through, that the duck-billed platypus was very much once a cryptid. Panda bears were a cryptid for a while. The okapi was a cryptid. And I mean, the duck-billed platypus, that totally seems made up. Like, how is that real?
Even when it was discovered, the scientific community rejected it, thinking it was just a fake taxidermy, like the jackalope.
Exactly. That's a fake. It couldn't possibly be real because that animal does not make sense scientifically. Like, how do you have this creature? And so I think that one, especially for me, is super fascinating. And I'm like, if that can be proven real, who knows what of these creatures could be real?
Have you ever made a platypus plushie?
A long time ago, yeah. Back when I was doing stuffed animals, I have.
Maybe you can do now a series of former cryptids.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Well, thank you for doing this. This was very fun. I usually do sometimes offensive, sometimes deep philosophical discussions, whatnot, but I really liked this whimsical episode that we did.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
So for the listeners, can you share where they can find you?
Absolutely. I'm on Instagram. That's my primary social media at cryptid_comforts. You can also go to cryptidcomforts.com, and that is my link to my social medias, my websites, the Cryptic Crate Junior, and everything else that I do. So cryptidcomforts.com has it all.
And I will link all of that in the episode description. And again, Lisa, thank you not just for joining me today to discuss this, but thank you for revitalizing a cool little legend.
Oh, I am happy to do it.
Yes, and also not a scary monster, but a cute one, just pushing it into the public consciousness.
Hey listeners, I need to inform you that we have recorded this episode back in December, I think. Wow, it's been quite a while. But back when we recorded it, Squonkapalooza was an idea that did not come to fruition yet, but ever since then, Lisa has helped make Squonkapalooza a reality. And what is Squonkapalooza, you may ask? Well, Squonkapalooza is an all-ages festival celebrating the squonk and other creatures of Appalachian and American folklore and cryptozoology. So yeah, guys, we're having the first ever Squonk Festival. So I guess pack your bags, guys, and plan a trip over to Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Squonkapalooza will be held on Saturday, August 26th at 507 Main Street, Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And the guest speakers include the MCs of the event, who will be Stir the Pot Podcast, along with Ron Murphy, Ashley Hilt, who you may know as Ashers, Cryptids of the Corn Podcast, Joshua Brucker, and a prior guest of my own podcast, Heather Mosier. So yeah, guys, plan a trip over there. This will be a very fun event. Lisa has been promoting it as an all-ages, family-friendly, very whimsical event that celebrates the often overlooked and smaller cryptids and creatures of folklore.
Doing 2022 Year of the Squonk, lately it's been on my mind with the new year fast approaching is, well, what's going to be 2023? Like, what cryptid should I feature for 2023? Because now that I've started doing this, I feel like I have to do it every year.
Well, maybe the Slide Rock Bolter, and then you use my idea for the next book.
Yeah, but 2023 Year of the Slide Rock Bolter doesn't roll off the tongue as much. God, it's got to sound good. It's got to be catchy. I'll figure it out.
Yes, yes. Well, until next time, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.